Little Emily biting her sister, or is teenage Barry refusing to help around the house? Consulting psychologist David Carey joins us to answer all your parenting woes.
It is time for our parenting slot. David Carey joins us once again. David, good afternoon.
Hi, Sean.
First question is this. I'm concerned about my four-year-old son's awareness of mortality. In the past few months, he's often asked about death. When either me or my husband will die, what will happen to him when we die? How long before any of us will die? We tell him that none of us will die for a very long time and talk about his great-grandmother's in her 90s and how long she's lived. Over the weekend, he asked me to make sure that our friends know that when I die, that he wants to go in the box with me. I think this might be due to all coffins around at Halloween. He hasn't asked what happens to us when we die. Neither of us are religious and don't want to talk about heaven as we don't believe in it. But I wonder, are we being too stark or honest with him? Is it easier to tell a young child that we'll all be together forever after death? He's a sensitive boy, a worrier, and will often break down in tears when he thinks about these kinds of things. Oh, God, love him.
Yeah, I think this is anxiety-driven in a very young child who's quite verbal and probably of above-average intelligence, because these are deep questions that aren't usually posed by four-year-olds. I think it reflects his uncertainty about where he belongs in the world. Now, there's a couple of questions embedded here. Is it easier to tell a young child that we'll all be together forever after death? Well, if that's your spiritual and religious belief, then there's no harm in saying that. If you don't believe that, because you're telling us that you're not very religious, then don't say it. No point in saying things to a child that you don't actually personally believe. They'll cop on pretty quick that you're not telling the truth. Likewise, I would question the wisdom of saying we're not going to die for a very long time. I don't think that's necessary. It's kind of a promise that you can't be guaranteed to keep either. I would suggest talking to this boy not so much about the specific question, but more about what he's worried about, more about why he's perhaps, is he unhappy, for example? What is it that he thinks about? How often are these questions occurring? Don't know enough to really offer more advice than that. This could just be a very bright but somewhat anxious young fellow. A lot of attention paid to these things means you get more of the same question also. So try to ask, respond very specifically to the questions asked, downplay it a little bit, move on to another subject. Don't entertain it. Don't get mired in it. Is it a morbid way of thinking? I don't think so in a four-year-old.
Don't all kids go through a stage of this?
Yeah, but not usually at age four.
Yeah, okay.
Interestingly, yes, because you're quite right. That usually comes in around age six, seven, eight. When they start asking these deep questions. And it's only the brighter ones that ask. Most of the average amongst us don't pose these questions until later on in life. Don't get upset by it. Let's try to take it easy. The less direct and intense attention you pay to it, the less likely it's bound to happen, I think.
Okay. This actually is a question that came in last week. Just in case anybody thinks we planted it here deliberately. But it is a genuine question. What kind of role model is Donald Trump? In light of his pathological misogyny and his videotaped admission of sexual assault, in light of Michelle Obama's recent powerful speech in response to his behavior, would it be possible for David to discuss ways in which parents can raise boys to grow into empathetic, compassionate, and tender young men? Men who don't despise women, men who are not fearful of women, men who are capable of seeing women as human beings, and not cartoon characters based on the saturation of pornography. How do fathers and mothers raise good boys? Now, obviously, they were prompted by the Donald Trump revelations, but really it's about the culture that's around young boys growing up.
Yes,
Trump's fault.
It isn't Donald Trump's fault, and no president, no political leader anywhere in the world serves as a real role model for young boys or young girls. The role models come from the parents in the family home. And therefore, I would say in response to this, yes, the best way to do that is to make sure parental roles are shared equally, if you have a partner at home, that is. and if you are a male-female couple. Therefore, the male can do the dishes, the male can do the cooking. Some of the time you switch off. You make sure that you each play with the children in an appropriate and developmentally appropriate way. You show your boys how to be respectful to women by being respectful to your wife or your female partner.
Yeah.
If you disrespect your female partner, your boy is going to learn to disrespect women. I get a lot of complaints from parents who are telling me that their son, usually a teenager and typically a boy with some self-regulation problems, is disrespectful to mother, often using foul language. What I hear very often is the father doesn't step up to the plate and draw a line in the sand and make it quite clear you can't talk to the mother that way. So the way to do this, to raise healthy boys, is for us to focus less on the girls and the problem of teenage pregnancy and all that sort of stuff and begin to teach boys to be respectful to women. We learn our role models from our parents. That's the reality.
Yeah, but is doing that enough for them to resist all what their peers might be saying or how their peers might be acting and, yeah, what they see online?
Yeah.
Which is, I suppose, you know, because they might well go, well, mom and dad are a different generation. That's a different thing. That's nothing to do with me. You know, for my peers, it's a completely different attitude.
Well, I think one of the things that needs to begin to happen in society, and we've all been very good at castigating Mr. Trump for using very foul and objectionable language about women. But there's far too much of that going on in the pub and in the locker room. This is not something that is confined to a presidential candidate. This is part of male culture. He even defined it as locker room talk.
Yeah.
Now, I reckon you've heard it. I know I've heard it. We need to begin to raise our young men from very young age that they will not incorporate that kind of talk into their vocabulary, and that if other people use it, it doesn't make it right, and they must reject it. All right, you don't have to make a big scene about it. Just walk away from it, and that's the end of that. This is a lifelong developmental process to raise men that will respect women. And the it goes in the opposite direction, by the way. We have to raise women that will respect men. We are all more human than anything else. And so we need to learn to live together, acknowledge our differences in terms of gender, but share our different gender roles. I think it's really important for men to begin to play a very significant role in the life of their young children. One of the things I've seen in Ireland, I first came here in 1970, by the way, 71. I can't remember from those days ever seeing a man pushing a pram.
Yeah.
You know?
It's true.
And now all I see is men pushing prams. And I see men feeding young babies in the shopping mall and bringing them in and changing their nappies. Things have changed a lot.
Yeah.
Now, exactly how that changed, I don't really know. Did we teach it? Or did it just evolve? Is it an artifact of women just beginning to say, no, I'm not going to allow myself and permit myself to be treated like this anymore? That probably is a big part of it, actually.
Yeah.
So it's a process over time. It isn't Mr. Trump's fault. And no president or prime minister is ever going to serve as a significant role model for young people. It's the parents.
Someone was saying to me that their kids saw on the news he was elected and then were saying, Daddy, is there going to be a world war?
Well, this is
kind of like your first question. You can't say absolutely no for sure.
You can. Well, that's very true. But part of the problem is there is now, and has been for quite a while, hysteria around this electoral process. And people are responding in very hyperbolic terms, and children are exposed to this, that now this man has the button, et cetera, the world could end. You know, is it going to play out like that? Quite frankly, I doubt it. I don't know. I make no guarantees one way or the other. But I think we need to be careful and mindful about what we put in the ears and minds and hearts of our children, how much of it we let them listen to, and how we phrase it ourselves.
One of my six-year-old twins has started excessive blinking for the past 2 months with some facial twitching. I check with the optician was fine. Should I see a neurologist or will it resolve by itself?
No, don't go to a neurologist yet. This is only 2 months long. 25% approximately of children and adults, by the way, develop a transitory tic. Mm. It just happens and then it goes away 6 months, a year, 2 months, who knows? There isn't a definitive time frame around this. It's nothing to be upset about. Do not draw attention to it. Don't say that's a bad habit, stop blinking, etc., because that only makes it perpetuate itself even more. Nothing to be alarmed about. Nothing. Mm-hmm. Just wait and see.
Yeah. We have a 16-year-old girl who's just gone into fifth year in school. She is demanding that she can go out at the weekends. We are saying only during school holidays, but we have several arguments since her return to school and have now come to compromise on our part that she goes out once a month during school. Were we right? What is reasonable in regard to going out for a 16-year-old?
Well, I can't tell you what's reasonable for going out. That depends on your family values and your own particular point of view with your partner. What is needed in these situations is a conversation between the parenting partners, if there are two, or a determination on the part of the sole parent as to what is appropriate based on your guidelines. If you think once a month is fine, okay, then stick with it. How long does she stay out? We don't know. That's something else you have to think about. Where is she going? Under what conditions? Is there supervision? Who is with whom is she going out, etc.? There's a lot of questions that need answering before you let a 16-year-old on the loose. She's going to say, all my friends are out.
Of course
she
is.
Which is probably true, but absolutely irrelevant. In the context of your family values, you must decide what the limits are, and you must apply them and stick to them. Now, 16 is of an age where we let them out to two teen discos
we do.
And whatnot.
It's very difficult to keep them in. The point that they compromised, at first they said no, and then they came to a compromise with it. Is that okay? Or does that send a sign of weakness?
No, not necessarily. It's okay if it's a compromise once in a while.
Yeah.
We all need to negotiate with our children, particularly our older teens, about what the boundaries and limits are. So occasional compromise is a healthy thing. And you will know how well the child adheres to the compromise by watching their future behavior. Constant waffling and saying something and then not following through is a sign of parental weakness.
Yeah.
And children pick up on that very quickly.
Of course, they have that in the back pocket if she, you know, slips up at all. We compromise for you.
Oh, yeah.
Now you have a holdover.
And you can be sure that if there's a younger sibling in the family, they'll be very quick X number of years later.
Oh, yeah.
You let Margaret go out when she was 16.
Yeah.
And not being able to recognize that Margaret may have had a different level of social and emotional intelligence than the other child. So there isn't one guideline. This is part of the problem.
You can't say that, though. You can't say, they were more mature than you were.
No, you can't. But you have to know it. And then follow through. Because some 16-year-olds are quite socially adept and have good social cognition and adhere to the limits and the boundaries. And some will push them enormously. And some you really have to be worried about when they're out there. If a 16-year-old has self-regulation issues, then we can't let them out late at night.
Mm.
There's too much potential trouble out there.
Oh, yeah.
It is always going to be a battle. These are the teenage years. Their job is to get you to back down.
Yeah.
Their job is to defeat you as a parent. Hold firm, compromise occasionally.
And you thought having a baby was difficult. Next question is this, David. My daughter-in-law is turning my granddaughter against me after a separation. What can I do?
Well,
thanks, upset granny.
That's very sad, actually. Children need loving parents and loving grandparents to play a role in their life. I emphasize the word loving because we tend to have a jaundiced view that all grandparents are wonderful creatures. They're not. Some of them can be very unpleasant to children.
Yeah.
So if it's true, then the only thing this poor woman can do is try to appeal to her son and make an inquiry about what he thinks may be going on here. This very often is a war between the parents, with children and grandparents being used as cannon fodder.
Yeah.
I've seen it before. perhaps it may be possible to ring up the daughter-in-law and meet over a cup of tea, not pointing fingers, but to express your love for the children and your desire to be a part of their life in some way, and see if, again, were you back to that word, compromise can be made. We don't know what's going on here. We don't know what's behind this. It's very unfortunate. Children, particularly if the children have had access to the grandmother in the past, in the sense that she's been a part of their life, and now all of a sudden she's not a part of their life or is being vilified.
Yeah,
that's damaging to the children.
Mm.
Now, yeah, beyond that, there isn't much upset granny can do, really.
Yeah.
Reach out, try to make some communication, and hope you can establish some new relationship. Mm. But
it's difficult to do because, well, we don't know when the separation was, but there's probably a lot of hurt and anger, and the daughter-in-law probably doesn't have anything to do with him, obviously, but his family either.
That's what I read into this, that there's a lot of hurt and pain. We don't know who's been nasty to whom.
Mm.
Perhaps the son is not an angel in all of this.
Yeah.
And I wonder if Gran has actually talked to her son and expressed her hurt. It's a hard place to be as a grandparent.
Yeah.
Because you want to enjoy your grandchildren. It's a new way. It's a new relationship. This one woman said to me after spending some time with her grandchildren, if I knew how easy it was and how wonderful it was, I would have had grandchildren first.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Because if you're a grandparent, you can just hand them back.
Yeah, hand them back. Yes. And it's all sweet and lovely.
Oh, that's a great thing about it. Now, next question is, what does David think of self-directed education with parental facilitation? For example, the unschooling model.
Well, what does any of that mean?
Yeah, I'll tell you what the unschooling model is. The unschooling model is a method of educating children that allows them to choose what they're interested in and to delve into it and study it without imposing a curriculum on them.
Ah, right.
So
okay.
It's basically free choice, a lot of exploration of the environment, and no set curriculum. And the theory behind it is that most of them by the age of 7 or 8 will learn to read anyway because their exploration of the world exposes them to the world of print, and therefore they will want to decipher it.
Mm.
So they will want to be taught to read. No one learns to read without being taught, although there are some theorists who say that's possible, but not really.
Mm.
You have to be directly taught to read or indirectly taught. So that's what unschooling is. Homeschooling, of course, is following the curriculum established by the Department of Education, but teaching it at home yourself. And that's regulated, as is unschooling, by the way, is regulated by the department. They inspect and assure that in the case of homeschooling, the revised standard curriculum in primary school or the curriculum in secondary school, the junior cert and leaving cert syllabus is being followed in the family home.
Yeah.
Unschooling, there is no curriculum, but that's sanctioned by the department too, as long as you register. I don't know how they supervise it, to be honest, because I've never met a family that follows the unschooling model. There's an Unschooling Ireland website, I believe, where you can actually use online resources to unschool your children.
Mm.
Now, what do I think of it? I don't know anyone who's gone through it. I haven't read into the research on it, so I don't have a scientific opinion. My general thinking is, in terms of homeschooling, it's better for children to be having regular access with other groups of children so their social and emotional intelligence develops. Now, that does not mean that all children who are homeschooled have no access with other children, because I know many of them do. There's a large homeschool group of people. They have tentacles through the internet that reach out very widely across Ireland, and they do meet up, and they see to it that their children meet and play and explore things and have fun together. So it isn't either or. It's about getting the mix right. You know, children are very, very resilient and versatile. Most of them grow up to be very functional adults, leading lives of quiet dignity and self-respect, whether they're schooled or unschooled. the opposite side of this is our traditional model of schooling can be very damaging to some children because it's very unimodal. It assumes that all children ought to go on to university, that academic success is the most important criteria for a successful living. We know it is not. Secondary schooling, in my opinion, is a form of splintered neglect in which we cram the head with massive amounts of knowledge, expect the head to remember it and regurgitate it back on examination time, and minimize the amount of social and emotional development of the child. So getting the balance right is tricky, but not impossible.
Speaking of schools, how do you know if your child has been bullied at school is doing okay? He's 11 years old on the autism spectrum. The bullying happened last year and the bully has now left the school.
Well, has your child's behavior returned to a reasonable form of baseline pre-bullying? In other words, what we talk about in psychology is their pre-morbid status before the trauma, before the insult. How was the child behaving? Now, this is a child on the spectrum, so a parent would have a very good view of how that child was behaving before the bullying started, and would have witnessed in the family home and in the community the upset and distress the child experienced as a result of being bullying. The best way to know if your child is over it is to observe their behavior pattern, sleep, eating, everything, and see, is it pretty much like what it was before the bullying? Then in that case, they're over it, in the sense that one ever gets over it. Because
yes.
I don't think anyone ever really gets over being bullied. If you talk to people who have been genuinely bullied, they remember it. It is a trauma. It's an area of upset and distress, but people are able usually to integrate it into their life and they move forward. It becomes a very unpleasant memory,
yeah,
but not one that stops their development.
Can it, though? I mean, if you have been bullied and, you know, as you say, severely bullied, if you encounter it again at some later stage in your life, can that provide a, you'll revert back to what you did before?
Yeah, that's a brilliant point of view. Yes, that's absolutely what happens, because the neural circuits that have been created by the bullying and trauma experience have been healed to a degree, and more productive neural circuits exist. But a new trauma introduced will resurrect the old trauma and perhaps magnify it a little bit. We see this all the time, actually, amongst people who are traumatized. So, yeah, you can integrate it. You can move past it. Sometimes people need counseling and therapy for that. Most often they don't. Mm. But if something else comes along, their reactions may be much more extreme than they would be if they hadn't been badly bullied.
Listen in every Wednesday at 3 p.m. here on Moncrief for more parenting advice from David Carey.